This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. A woman who hails from a minority ethnic community has been chosen as India's new president on Thursday. Draupadi Murmu became the first president from one of the country's tribes and the second ever female president of India. Votes to elect Murmu as the new president were polled by the Indian parliament and state legislatures on Monday. Murmu, a leader from India's ruling party, is now a member of the Santal ethnic minority and one of the country's largest tribal groups. She started out as a teacher before entering politics. She will formally be sworn in as the president on Monday. President's role in India is largely ceremonial and bound by the advice of the cabinet led by the prime minister. Italian Premier Mario Draghi resigned on Thursday after key coalition allies boycotted a confidence vote, signaling the likelihood of an early election and a renewed period of uncertainty for Italy and Europe as a critical time. Draghi tendered his resignation to the president, Sergio Mattarella, during a morning meeting at the palace. Mattarella, who rejected a similar resignation offer from the premier last week, took note of the new one and asked Draghi's government to remain on in a caretaker fashion. AP correspondent Nicole Winfield reports that most commentators believe that most likely scenario is that Italy's president will call elections as early as September or even October.
That means that the final period of the summer will involve campaigning for those elections. Polls currently suggest that a center-right alliance could win, given that they topped the polls and have done well recently in local and administrative elections.
Draghi's government of national unity imploded Wednesday. This is VOA News. According to officials and witnesses, a barrage of Russian shelling pounded a densely populated area in Ukraine's second-largest city, killing at least two people. We get more from AP correspondent Zaria Shackley.
The shelling comes a day after Russia reiterated its plans to seize territories beyond eastern Ukraine. Kharkiv officials say Russian forces hit a medical facility, a public transport stop, a mosque, a gym, and a residential building, also injuring 21 people. Associated Press reporters in Kharkiv say a market was also hit and saw a woman crying over the body of her dead husband. I'm Zaria Shackley.
Two Texas men have been indicted in the heat-related deaths of 53 migrants. We get more from AP correspondent Tim McGuire.
A federal grand jury indicting truck driver Homero Zamorano and Christian Martinez on a number of charges in the deaths of 53 migrants and heat-related injuries to more than a dozen others found packed inside a hot airless tractor trailer rig last month on a remote road in San Antonio. Convictions could result in life sentences for the pair. The U.S. Attorney's Office could also authorize prosecutors to seek the death penalty. The 53 dead were from Mexico and three Central American nations. It is the deadliest known smuggling attempt in the United States. San Antonio has seen two previous similar incidents. 10 people dying while trapped in a trailer in 2017. 19 migrants found dead in a trailer in 2003. I'm Tim McGuire.
Former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, Brazil, is now officially entering the country's presidential race. We get more details from VOA's Richard Green.
The 76-year-old leftist will be nominated by his Workers' Party to run against far-right incumbent President Jair Bolsonaro in the October 2nd vote. He currently holds a double-digit lead in opinion polls over Bolsonaro. A victory would represent a remarkable comeback by Lula, who led Brazil for two terms from 2003 to 2010 before spending over 2 years in prison on corruption charges. The convictions were later annulled. Bolsonaro's baseless claims that Brazil's electronic voting system is susceptible to fraud has raised fears he will refuse to concede defeat in October. Richard Green, VOA News, Washington.
Meanwhile, the World Health Organization is convening its emergency committee to consider for the second time within weeks whether the expanding outbreak of monkeypox should be declared a global crisis. Recapping our top story, a woman who hails from a minority ethnic community has been chosen as India's new president on Thursday. Draupadi Murmu became the first president from one of the country's tribes and the second ever female president of India. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
So it delivered at scale. Millions of new cases could be averted and tens of thousands of lives saved every year.
That was WHO Regional Director for Africa, Machi Diso Moeti, on plans for the mass rollout of the world's first malaria vaccine. Details coming up. Also, the White House has announced a U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit December 13th through the 15th. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Today in Mali, the commander of the French troops in Operation Barkhane held a news briefing about the withdrawal of the troops from Mali. General Laurent Michon spoke about plans for French military support for anti-extremist operations in other countries in the Sahel. Earlier, VOA's Kate Pond-Dawson spoke with journalist and regional analyst Catherine Field in Paris about General Michon's comments. They also spoke about French President Emmanuel Macron's visit to West Africa next week.
Essentially, General Laurent Michon was saying goodbye. He was saying that France is disengaging from Mali, the soldiers and the equipment are now being airlifted to Niger. He said that it was going according to plan and that by his reckoning, France will be out of Niger by the end of August. Although there are others who say it could be earlier than that. What in particular he's saying about the withdrawal from Mali is that it's going without any incidents, because there was always that concern that even if they were going out by plane, there would be jihadist attacks on some of the forces around the air bases, that sort of threat. So that hasn't happened. The other thing he did say was that Barkhane is leaving, it is leaving Mali, but it will change. He's saying that they're going now to more of a support, more of an aid-type operation that will be essentially moved and coming out of Niger.
I understand he had some criticisms of Mali's relationship with troops from the Wagner group out of Russia. What was he saying?
He was very specific on this point. General Michon said that he had no problem at all working with members of the Malian forces and of the soldiers that they were training. He said the real problem there at the moment now are these Wagner mercenaries, of which he said there are at least 1,000. He said that not only is it that everywhere they go there seems to be violence, but he said they are getting a stranglehold on the economy in Mali, and in particular, he said that there are new mining licenses being given out, and he thinks that the Wagner group is going to get those. So in particular, he said that just everywhere that this Wagner group seems to turn up, there seems to be violence as well.
Now, I understand this was followed by a briefing at the Elysee Palace in Paris, also talking about the U.S. defense posture in the Sahel. What was being said there?
What was being said is that making it clear that just because France is pulling out of Mali and just because we're seeing the end of Barkhane doesn't mean that it's the end of French and in particular European engagement in that region and right across the Gulf of Africa, that whole region. In particular, we're looking at next week the French president visiting Cameroon, Benin and Guinea-Bissau. Now, in particular, France is very concerned about two countries, Togo and Benin. They are really quite aware that jihadist groups are working in the north of these countries and that these countries will need support. There's been no request for French troops to be present on the ground there. What they are saying, though, is that France will supply aerial support, equipment, intelligence, and they will also help train some of these countries' troops. So they're going there to show that France has a role to play and that Europe has a role to play. The other interesting point about the visit to Cameroon is that until quite recently, there have been quite tense relationships between France and Cameroon. Well, apparently they've moved on. They want to move this relationship on further. And in particular, they want to do more when it comes to cooperation, particularly when it comes not just to the armed forces, but also more cooperation when it comes to food supplies, because that's the other thing that Emmanuel Macron has been saying very clearly, that food security is really at a risk at the moment, and that something more has to work so any type of food shortages are alleviated. In particular, they want to see an increase in food production, help augment the possibilities for agriculture, particularly in Cameroon and in Benin.
That was journalist and analyst Catherine Field. She was speaking by phone from Paris with VOA's Kate Pondarson. To cement his power grab, Tunisian President Kais Saied has been counting on a passive response from the country's allies in the European Union and the United States, which have only issued verbal admonishments. The most recent EU statement was especially passive. It merely takes note of concerns about the proposed new constitution that will be the subject of a referendum Monday. Some counter-revolutionary players in the Arab world contributed to Saied's power grab. Radwan Masmoudi, president of Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi how the international community could save Tunisia from a potential one-man rule.
Well, actually, Mohamed, this new constitution was written by Kais Saied himself, and it would give him unlimited and unchecked powers. There is no separation of powers in this new constitution, and there is no checks and balances, especially on the executive branch and especially on the powers of the president himself. He basically wrote in the constitution that he's accountable to no one for any actions that he commits or undertakes while exercising his duties. Basically, he's immune from any criticism. I think this constitution is much worse than the one we had before the revolution, and even Bourguiba and Ben Ali did not have such unlimited and unchecked powers as the ones that Kais Saied will have if this constitution is adopted.
The new constitution does not specify a percentage of voters that would make voting on the constitution legitimate. So even boycotting the referendum by political parties and angry voters would not prevent the president from ratifying his draft. Saied has appointed a new elected commission, casting some doubt over the credibility of any vote on Monday. How could that impact the democratic transition in Tunisia?
Well, I mean, I think that many scholars and experts in Tunisia and politicians said that if this constitution is adopted and is passed, it will be the end of democracy in Tunisia. There is no question about it. There is no threshold for ratifying this constitution. I mean, this is really ironic. Many people in Tunisia have insisted on having a threshold of at least 50% of the registered voters, and at least two-thirds of those who vote must approve the new constitution. This is what you typically have in any referendum on the constitution anywhere in the world. But Kais Saied has refused to put a threshold. And so theoretically, this constitution could pass or could be ratified with only 10% or 15% of the registered voters, which of course is a joke. All the political parties in Tunisia, with the exception of one small party, are calling on Tunisians to boycott the referendum. And that is why I expect the turnout to be very low, maybe around 10% or maximum 15%. But that is also why Kais Saied has replaced most of the members of the Electoral Commission, the governors, and even the judges. He has replaced them, and he has fired the independent judges who will be in charge of running and monitoring the referendum. So clearly, there is almost a certainty that the results will be rigged in his favor and will be whatever he wants them to be.
That was Radwan Masmoudi, president of Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. As tensions and threats of industrial strikes rise in South Africa due to rising fuel prices, unemployment, crime and poverty, the country is turning to local black industrialists to boost the economy. Inflation has hit a record high, and economists warn it is set to worsen. President Cyril Ramaphosa yesterday convened the the first ever Black Industrialists and Exporters Conference in a bid to grow the economy through local empowerment. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
The South African government is taking no chances with inflation at a record 7.4%, unemployment hovering around 35%, gasoline prices heading towards $1.75 per litre, and more unions threatening work protests. Ramaphosa yesterday assured local black industrialists and exporters that the government will do all it can to ensure they excel in business.
Self-employment and entrepreneurship are the engines of growth and job creation in any other economy. They support innovation, they boost competitiveness, and bring new products and services into the economy.
Ramaphosa said that since the Black Industrialists Program was formed in 2015, over $3 billion has been given as loans or support grants. However, with power cuts lasting several hours per day, most industrialists complained that the electricity shortage is setting them up for failure. Ramaphosa assured them of a quick resolution to this challenge.
We need to act decisively and urgently to end load shedding in our economy. That is why I've brought together all relevant departments and entities to add additional power to our grid in the shortest possible time.
But for many citizens who are struggling with rising prices, these interventions could be too little too late. As Ramaphosa addressed the black industrialists, residents of Tembisa Township in West Rand were blocking roads with burning tires and rocks, protesting against the high cost of living. This resident told journalists why.
You pay so much, maybe, let's take for example, 800 rand today, this month. Next month it increases again. And then we are paying until storage separate, water separate, and then even refuse separate. It's too much.
With some public servants already engaged in industrial action, many unions are threatening to strike too. Zingiswa Losi, president of the Congress of the South African Trade Unions, told the media that workers are failing to cope with the economic challenges.
There's a worker who's working for Pick and Pay who was earning 2,500 rands. But the cost of transport to get to work is 3,500. And these are the challenges that workers are confronted with.
However, Kuseni Lameni, chairman of the board of the South African Smasmart Holdings, is one of many black industrialists who expressed hope during panel discussions at the conference.
There's a massive opportunity to be captured globally if we target the top global multinationals in the world and try and twin them and align them with local black industrialists.
The black industrialists say they are eyeing the Africa Free Trade Continental Trade Area to vigorously search for new markets on the continent. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Please note we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. Preparations are underway for the mass rollout of the world's first malaria vaccine funded by Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, for nearly $160 million to protect millions of children in Africa. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The World Health Organization says Gavi's multi-million dollar funding marks a key advance in the fight against one of Africa's most severe public health threats. It notes that countries in sub-Saharan Africa bear the brunt of the yearly toll of more than 240 million global cases of malaria, including more than 600,000 reported deaths. The main victims are children under age five. WHO Regional Director for Africa, Machidiso Moeti, says one child dies every minute in Africa, with catastrophic consequences for families, communities, and national development. The vaccine was introduced in Africa in 2019. Since then, more than 1.3 million children have benefited from the life-saving inoculations in three pilot countries, Ghana, Kenya, and Malawi. Moeti says those countries have reported a 30% drop in hospitalizations of children with severe malaria and a 9% reduction in child deaths.
So if delivered at scale, millions of new cases could be averted and tens of thousands of lives saved every year. We were encouraged to see that the demand for the vaccine is high, even in the context of COVID-19, with the first dose reaching between 73% to over 90% coverage.
Managing Director of Country Programs at Gavi, Thabani Mafosa, calls the vaccine the most effective tool in the fight against malaria. He says the vaccine will save children's lives. However, he notes demand for the life-saving product will outstrip supply.
Our challenge during this critical phase is to ensure the doses we have available are used as effectively and equitably as possible. With this in mind, Gavi today is opening an application window for malaria support.
He says the three pilot countries will have the first crack at applying for and receiving funding. He adds that those countries already have experience in rolling out the vaccine, so practically speaking, he says, they will require little help in setting up their systems to get the operation underway. Mafosa says a second round of funding will take place at the end of the year. At that time, he says, other countries that have moderate to high cases of severe malaria will be able to submit applications for support. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Nigerian army says it's found one of the so-called Chibok girls who were kidnapped 8 years ago by the Islamic extremist group Boko Haram. The French news agency AFP reported this is the third in recent weeks. 276 schoolgirls ages 12 to 17 were abducted from their boarding school in Chibok in northeastern Nigeria in 2014. Their plight sparked a global campaign under the hashtag Bring Back Our Girls. Christopher Musa, commander of troops in the region, presented Ruth Bitteros, 24, along with her two-year-old son, to journalists. He did not say when she was found. She was 16 when she was kidnapped. She said she escaped at night and walked for 3 days through the bush before reaching the town of Bama and approached troops. 57 of the original captives managed to escape, and another 80 have been exchanged for Boko Haram commanders. Other girls were later found, but more than 100 remain missing. According to propaganda videos, many were forcibly married to Boko Haram fighters. The White House announced yesterday it will hold a U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit December 13th through the 15th. Joseph Siegel, director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, says the Biden administration is seeking more engagement in Africa to elevate the importance of democracy, knowing that it needs to play a stronger leadership role. Otherwise, that space will be filled by other international actors, often those with the nefarious interests, including non-state actors like violent extremist groups.
I think the U.S. is trying to assert more or leadership and, advance some common interest with Africa.
Do you think that the Biden administration is trying to counter China's influence in Africa by holding this summit?
I don't think that's the primary motivation, and it's often overlooked that the U.S. has far longer ties in Africa than is commonly recognized. The United States has cooperation efforts, dating back at least 8 decades in Africa across a whole host of fronts, economic, developmental, humanitarian, trade, cultural, security. And so there's a lot of common interest there between the United States and Africa. And I think the primary motivation is really to put a positive trajectory on what this means and to reaffirm those shared interests. And I think there's going to be a very strong focus on economic opportunities and how to expand U.S. foreign direct investment and trade and economic cooperation on the continent.
I'm thinking back on the 2014 first Africa Leaders Summit that was held by President Obama then. Do you expect heads of state to attend this summit as they did back then?
Absolutely. I think there's a strong interest on the part of many African leaders in engaging with the United States. Indeed, I would go so far as to say, you know, the United States is the preferred partner for many African countries. The question has been, you know, how engaged is the United States going to be in Africa? And so I think there will be a high level of receptivity. You know, African governments would welcome more U.S. investment, more trade, and more, you know, job creation that would be generated from more fulsome U.S. engagement on the continent.
Several African countries, as you know, are mired in conflict. Ethiopia, Burkina Faso, Mali, South Sudan, Sudan, just to name a few. Will the Biden White House be able to focus on what then-President Obama called the ingredients of progress when he hosted that first summit, strengthening governments on which economic development and free societies depend, he said, the rule of law, accountable and transparent institutions? Is that even attainable in some of these countries?
Well, I think it certainly is attainable. And you're right, there are 16 African countries, actually, that are in conflict in one form or another right now. And so there has been deterioration. Moreover, you know, this summit will be happening in a period where we've seen a considerable democratic backsliding on the continent. There are now more authoritarian-leaning countries than democratic-leaning countries in Africa. That wasn't the case just a few years ago. And this is a result of, you know, the coups we've seen. You know, there have been 6 coups in Africa since 2020. There have been 13 African leaders who have circumvented term limits since 2018. And so there's been some very definite democratic backsliding. I think, you know, one of the questions for the summit is how strongly issues of governance are going to be emphasized. Because as we've seen, countries that uphold democratic norms are more likely to respect the rule of law. They're more likely to avoid conflict. They're going to be better development partners.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA's Carol Van Dam in Washington. Washington wants to foster billions of dollars of investment in Africa. That's the message that Alice Albright, Chief Executive Officer for the U.S. Development Agency Millennium Challenge Corporation, gave to the U.S.-Africa Business Summit being held at the Moroccan city of Marrakesh. She emphasized that Washington wants to create jobs and build inclusive, sustainable economic growth and prosperity across Africa. According to the French news agency AFP, the Marrakesh meeting, organized by the private group, the Corporate Council on Africa, brings together African political and business leaders, as well as decision makers and investors from the U.S. private sector. Moroccan Foreign Minister Nassar Bourita said, as he opened the talks yesterday, it is time for Africa to play its natural and central role on the international stage. Fighting climate change, the energy transition, food security, health, agriculture, infrastructure, new technologies, and the digital divide are among the key issues for discussion. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Cornelius Tanner, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.